You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together. Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. Today I am joined by Coach Arian Kamesi of Squats and Sciences. Arian actually just won USAPL Coach of the Year, so congratulations.
Thank you.
So Arian, let's start off by you just giving a little background about yourself, how you get into powerlifting in general.
Well, if we just start with how I started lifting, that would be back in around 2001 or 2002 when I started high school. My cousin got me into lifting, and then obviously took a weightlifting class in high school, continued that into college at Florida State University. So over there, they had some bench-only competitions that the gym ran like once a year. So I would do that once a year, the bench-only competition, until I found out there's an actual weightlifting club at Florida State. So I joined up with the weightlifting club. Eventually, they ran a non-sanctioned powerlifting competition at FAMU's gym, actually. So I did that one. And then finally, my buddy, Dr. Mike Sordos, got us into USA Powerlifting. February 2011 was my first competition.
When you guys were doing the unsanctioned meet, what year was that?
That was end of 2010. So basically did that non-sanctioned one, I think maybe October or November 2010, and then did the sanctioned one soon after, February 2011.
What have you noticed the changes from when you competed February 2011 to what you've seen up until now in 2018?
Obviously, a lot more competitions, a lot more lifters, stronger lifters. And one thing that I actually discussed with one of my lifters a couple of weeks ago was a lot more female lifters. So if I go back and look at the results of that competition, 2011, there was maybe 8 to 10 women out of a 50 to 60 lifter competition. Now, when you do competitions, like I ran one in New York a few months ago, it was almost a 50-50 split.
Holy shit. That's actually, and you've kind of seen that trend. And I remember last year at Nationals, we were just kind of looking back at the history of like the 52 kilogram class. And I think even in, it was either 2013 or 2014, there were like 5 52s. Like there was such a small number, and then there were 42 last year. So like the growth of female powerlifting, I think is, it's huge.
Yes, definitely. And depending on the divisions, and obviously raw and equipped, there's different amounts. So I've seen on the bench only side, there tends to be still very male dominant. But when you look at the full powerlifting, especially the raw full powerlifting, there's definitely more and more women getting involved at the international and national level.
Yeah, that's awesome. So 2011, you compete in your first meet. You're still in college at this time?
Yes.
All right. So you're competing in powerlifting and going to school. How'd you get into coaching?
So that's the question everyone asks me. And there isn't an exact date or time period where you can say, oh, this is when I officially became a coach. It kind of just happens. And it even happened sort of even before I got into powerlifting, and then maybe other people have similar experiences with just lifting weights or any other sport, is you kind of train with maybe roommates or friends or family members. And if you know more information, you kind of show them the ropes. So I would go maybe do a workout with my roommate, and I would say, okay, let's do this workout I found online, 5 sets of 5 on bench press and then close grip bench, whatever. So it's kind of like helping people along the way, learning the information online. When it came to actual sanctioned competitions, learning the rule book, reading it, and passing the information along with our weightlifting team. So we had our president who started the team, which is Jordan Burke, and then who actually runs the gym up in New York. And then our buddy who was getting his doctorates, Mike Sordos, who's now a professor at FAU, was the one that got us into USA Powerlifting. So they were the guys who were the most knowledgeable at first, but they would pass the information down to me and others. And then once they left, then I would kind of take over and coach and pass information along to others. So wasn't a set date, kind of just happened with the team. Whoever was available at the competition to handle would do it. And then I would just get more and more involved with it with USAPL.
And so how did Squats and Sciences come about?
So Jordan Burke actually had the idea. For anyone who knows, the big thing about Squats and Science is the open barbell, which now he's making a new version called Rep 1. So before it was just a tendo unit. There was a couple of different variations out there, mostly collegiate teams and university. Collegiate teams and professional teams would use it because it cost maybe, I think, $2,000 or $3,000 for the device and the software. You couldn't just go buy it. So he always thought that he can build that same thing for less than half the price. It turns out he can do it actually for about a tenth of the price, since he's been making it for about $200 or $300.
Jesus.
So that was his first idea back in maybe 5-7 years ago. And that's kind of how he first started the business. And so then eventually he came to me and said, hey, we're already running the Squats and Science company built around this device and other things. He put together wrist wraps, ammonia salts. And he said, why don't you do the online coaching under our name? That way you get more of a draw from the crowd. So that's what I did. I joined them eventually.
So the open barbell, so you're saying a tendo unit. So like they were kind of ahead of the curve with the whole like measuring bar speed and stuff as a means of, I'm assuming, assessing training fatigue.
Yes. So the main person I would say in powerlifting that started was probably Mike Teixeira, since he actually had a tendo unit. And so did Matt Gary over SSPT. Those are the two big names I knew that had the original tendo unit. And then there's another one, Jim Aware.
So let's get into a little detail on how you guys actually use the open barbell system and bar speed to dictate training variables.
So there's lots of different ways to do it based on, just like if you were doing RPE, for example, you would pick whether it be the first set or the last set, or maybe do a top set and back off. So there's lots of different ways you can do the programming. But the first thing that you would want to do is to develop a velocity graph for your specific person and for each specific lift, since each person is going to be different depending on their leverages and experience level, and each lift is going to be different depending on the range of motion. So you would first have to develop that. So there's different ways to do it, but a lot of them suggest doing 2 or 3 singles at specific percentages and averaging those speeds to get a single average speed for 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%, and then you can plot that and create a graph. Once you have that information, then you know at what speed your one rep max is going to be. And based off of that, you can build your programming, whether you want to work up to a top single at a certain velocity, or maybe you want to stay at a certain weight and continue doing sets and reps until your velocity drops below a certain threshold. There's lots of different ways to do it.
What's the main use of it that you use with your clients? Is it more of a, once a bar speed slows, you'd drop weight or drop volume there, or building up to certain numbers? What's the main way you use it?
So for my clients, most of them don't have it. Some of them purchased it on their own. And sometimes if I meet up with some of my clients in person, I'll use mine. So most of mine don't have it. But if I have a client that has one and they're not with me, it's a distance coaching, then usually I use it for the top set. So if they're working up to a top single, I'll give them a velocity to kind of fall into a range of maybe 0.03 meters per second range. And could be the same for a top set of 2 or 3. And then the back off work usually would just be taking a certain amount of percentage off of that and just doing your sets normally. For my lifters in person, it's pretty much the same thing. Other than I'm looking at the velocity and based on what I want that day for a top set, then I'll adjust the weight.
So basically, when you're looking at bar speed, say you're working up to something heavy, you're basically setting something in there so they're not just grinding something out, right? They're not just kind of like going for, you're kind of letting them take a heavy single, but kind of putting a cap on it. Is that what the velocity training kind of tends to do?
Yeah. And everything is a tool in the toolbox, as people say. So whether what the person felt like themselves, what the coach sees as the bar speed or technique, what the velocity says, the average velocity is the main one we're looking at. What the average velocity says, you put that together, as Mike Teixeira says, to get the right weight on the bar for that day. And it can also be used for speed days, as they do with conjugate training on West Side. They'll do a speed day and it has to say, let's say 0.8 meters per second. Well, it's good for, especially for teams. You have people run in on the bench and go do their speed work. If it hits 0.8 meters per second, they stay at that weight. If it's higher, 1 meter per second, they add weight. And if it's lower, obviously, then they need to take off weight. It's especially good for teams. There was a West Side gym down here in Miami that used to have one, and they would get all the high school kids come in there. And for them, it's all a competition and it's all ego. So a lot of them try to put too much weight on the bar and say it's easy. So that gives them the definitive answer saying, nope, your speed is too slow. You have to drop the weight and hit the correct velocity.
And it can probably kind of turn their focus instead of competing for weight in the bar, they can compete for who's moving it the fastest or something.
Yeah, that's a fun game too that we've done at the gym.
Yeah, right. So for the people who don't have an open barbell system, do you use like RPEs?
Yeah. So for my clients, it depends on how experienced they are with RPEs. If they're beginners or intermediates, they don't feel comfortable with RPEs, I go with percentage training. If they feel comfortable with RPEs, it's usually giving them an RPE and a guess of what the percentage should be of what I think it should be for that day. That way they get in the target for that day and they can always adjust it up or down based on the RPE. And going back to the velocity training, there are other ways with video analysis to get your velocity. So there's apps out there, I think, that can track the bar. I use a program online, a physics software that I know Mike Teixeira, I believe, is the one who recommends me, called Tracker. And if I have a still video where I can track the barbell for the entire range of motion, then obviously I can, from that the position of the barbell, I can get my velocity and acceleration in the vertical direction and get velocity that way for a lift.
How much does that software cost?
That software is free. If you will search Tracker on Google, they can download the software. And it's actually good because I can track the end of a barbell to look at, for example, if there's any horizontal change in their squat with the bar coming forward. I can check what the lowest acceleration point is in the range of motion to see where their weakness is. And obviously I can do the average velocity as well to see what maybe their lowest average velocity is for a max squat.
That's actually pretty cool. So what do you think the biggest advantages of using some type of software to track velocity of the barbell? Maybe just hit some like top three points of why you should do this.
For the software, you mean?
Yeah, for using some type of software or some type of tracking system for velocity of the barbell.
So for myself, the biggest thing I use the software for is actually what I mentioned with the weak points or weak range of motion, is calculating the acceleration of the entire range of motion, seeing where the acceleration is the lowest, because that is where you're going to be weakest in the lift, and then figuring out why it is, whether it's a technical issue, whether they need to use a variation to build it up. But if you just want to compare velocity for a max lift or maybe reps, it would be good if maybe you're doing the same single, let's say, two different weeks or maybe two different cycles, and you can actually calculate your average velocity, see if there's an improvement, if it's hard to gauge whether there's an improvement RPE-wise. Sometimes with maybe RPE-8, it's kind of a range. It's kind of tricky. Is that really 8 or 8.5? So using that average velocity, then you can use that to be a little more definitive of whether you've made improvements or not.
That's actually, that's a good point. Cause like for an RPE nine, right, I know for me personally, there's a certain point where I can put weight on the bar and it's a nine, but I know I can go up and hit a nine at a heavier weight. And I know I can go up, but I know I couldn't double that weight. So using some type of like velocity tracker would kind of help me track the differences within like that range. Once we're getting closer to like a max lift, that makes sense to me. So you actually use it more as like a monitoring tool for the lifter's technique and to get the weight on the bar, more so than for determining volume. Because I believe some velocity-based, I think you kind of alluded to this too, programs tend to cut volume once velocity begins to slow down to a certain point. But for you, it's more of a like a monitoring tool?
Yeah. I haven't implemented that kind of volume auto-regulation into my programming, just because I only have a couple of lifters that have access to the actual open barbell, and they just haven't been with it enough time with me to get the graphs and build towards that. But I know Jordan Burke, who runs the gym in New York, SNS Barbell, since he has so many members there and he has open barbells there, people can grab and use the app to enter all your data in. and he runs a little bit of research there. He actually does give them free programming, and a lot of it's velocity-based programming, and a lot of it does have that volume auto-regulation as well as intensity auto-regulation.
That's pretty cool. I'd love to hear more about that stuff too. So you do both in-person and online coaching, correct?
I'm pretty much entirely online. The only people I meet in person these days are, I have a few clients that are within an hour or two of me. So sometimes I'll drive up to one of our original gyms, Boynton Barbell Center. It's about an hour away from me. So then my lifters from the other area can meet up there. We can train in person some Saturdays, like leading up to a competition. I had a lifter who just did our Florida State Championships. It was our first equipped meet. So we had to meet up a lot of Saturdays so I can wrap her knees, get her in the bench shirt, that kind of stuff.
What percentage of your online clients are equipped as opposed to raw?
It's pretty much all raw. I've had one lifter who did equipped sub-junior worlds, but she just used knee wraps for squat and a bench shirt for bench, nothing for deadlift. And then I had a lifter who did the Arnold deadlift challenge. We just used a suit for the deadlift. And then this lifter of mine did her first equipped meet. It was mostly to get a equipped bench in because we want to take her to bench nationals to do raw and equipped there. But we end up getting other pieces of equipment. So we figured we might as well just do the whole competition with the equipment for her to have some fun, try it out.
Are there any things that differ for velocity-based training for equipped versus raw lifters?
The big thing I've noticed with bench press, especially the super heavyweights, because Blaine Sumner has one of her open barbells and he would test out, is there's so much horizontal travel in a bench shirt, especially for the equipped lifters, the super heavyweights, I mean, who touch low on their belly, that there's issues with tracking the velocity. It almost calculates two reps because it's getting confused between how much horizontal distance is away from the open barbell device and how much vertical distance it is. With equipped benching, also sometimes there's a little up and down motion in the transition from the shirt into the arms. So we've had some issues with that with the bench shirt, I've noticed.
Okay. That's interesting. So what are some of the challenges that you find trying to coach people primarily online, especially when you're trying to implement something where they're monitoring themselves with the open barbell system?
Well, the big thing I'm sure every online coach has, and you probably dealt with, is difficult fixing technique online. When you're not there in person to physically show them, possibly grab them on their shoulder or wherever you need to make the adjustment and make those adjustments every rep or every set in a training session, it becomes difficult. So you have to basically have them send you videos, then you review the videos and try and explain it to them in words, or maybe do your own video demonstrating it, have them go back to the next training session, try it again, and just keep doing that back and forth until you can make the adjustment.
How many lifters do you have, online lifters?
It goes up and down right now. I would say I'm probably around 25.
So you have 25 people taking videos, sending them in. Do you give them the feedback real time, or do you kind of do it when you get a minute? How does that work?
So I give a lot of freedom to lifters to do it whichever way is best for them and they can stay more consistent with. But the base level, which I do, which a lot of other coaches do, is everyone sends a weekly update email once a week. And so let's say they send on Saturday, in that email, they'll explain how their training went, if they missed any reps, if they have any issues coming up next the following weeks with vacation or anything like that. And they'll put in also their training videos. And then I'll go in there and I'll read everything. I'll look at the programming. I'll watch the videos. I'll say what kind of technique changes they may need to make adjustments to the training numbers for the following weeks, and send it back. So that's the minimum way. But I give the option to lifters if they want to send their videos in after every training session each day, and I can review it then. For some lifters, they've done Instagram live of their training session, and I'll be commenting in the chat saying, oh, you should do this or go up into this weight for your heavy single. So it just depends on what the lifter wants to do.
I mean, it's good that you have flexibility like that, because, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, like I know like some of the online ones that I have, they get a little like in their heads with technique sometimes. So it's like at least having me look at the video instead of them just sitting there harping on every small detail tends to help a little bit and others, they just, it's kind of the same thing. We kind of chat once a week, but at worst, you have conversations in some way, shape or form with each lifter once a week.
Yes. And many of them will message me during the week. Especially at the very beginning, when they're starting a program with me, it's possible that maybe they haven't done that variation or that accessory exercise before that I'm asking them, or maybe they do a different way that I would like. So it's good that they'll send me a video of their barbell good mornings and be like, is this correct or not? And I'll tell them like, oh, you should make these adjustments for your next set. And then they can go video their next set and say, hey, does this look better or worse? And can make those adjustments early on.
Okay. Do you have like a video library for them to like look at for the variations? Or so say like I'm your lifter, I have a pause squat or something in there. I've never done a pause squat before. Would you just explain it to them? Or do you have like a, I'm actually asking for my own knowledge, because I don't have a video library. I just kind of like wing it. But I'm curious how you go about doing that.
So I would say, I guess I have three methods of getting the information to them. One is when I send the initial training block. The exercises I know where people usually haven't done or maybe they have issues with, I'll put in there, hey, this is how I want you to execute these exercises in Word. Like I'll type it out. Then I'll also sometimes send videos online from YouTube, because I don't think I need to recreate what a pin squat or a pin press or a good morning looks like when there's already YouTube videos out there showing it that are probably better quality and better production. So I'll just send those videos to them. And in addition to that, if there's specific issues that I see common to my lifters, or maybe to even the one lifter, or a way that I like the exercise executed that's not out there, then I just make the video myself. I was going to a CrossFit gym right next to me for about 3 or 4 years. So I would just shoot videos in there. Now I've moved out of there, but I've actually shot videos like in my backyard, or yesterday I actually shot a couple of videos in my bedroom with just a barbell and weights on there, showing different angles of how to do a stiff legged deadlift, how to do a Romanian deadlift, that kind of stuff.
All right. You know, I never even thought of just stealing other people's videos. That's actually a really good idea. So we were talking kind of about some of the hard parts of coaching people online, but what are some of the things you enjoy about coaching people online?
I like the access to everyone. So in this day and age with internet, social media and everything, I don't have to try and find powerlifters that are serious about powerlifting just in Miami where I live, which there aren't that many. And if they are, Miami's a big city. It's a little far away to drive to a gym and try and talk with the owners. So figure out a pricing that I pay them so I can coach my lifters there. With internet, I can access people all across the country and the world. So I can reach a lot more powerlifters since there aren't that many of us. So I like that part.
Right. You wouldn't have Justina or Shannon if it wasn't for the internet.
Exactly.
How many times does Justina text you a week?
It depends on how good or bad our week is going.
All right. So let's get into like your coaching career a little bit. So up until this point, what has been the highlight of your coaching career?
The highlight. Well, I guess if we want to talk about the timeline with USA Powerlifting, is the first national championship me and my buddies did was 2012 Raw Nationals in Texas. So actually, that's like my first time coaching at a national level competition. And then I became an assistant coach for a national team in 2014, two different teams. Also in 2015, two different teams. And then 2016 through now, I've been a head coach for a national team. So between that 2012 and now, I'm not sure if I can pick a certain moment, but definitely our 2015 team for Raw Worlds in Finland, that was a pretty good experience. That was like my first time actually getting a lot more hands-on with the team, because the old coach was transitioning out and trying to transition new coaches. So being able to handle, for example, Kim Wofford or Blaine Sumner, helping them pick attempts and everything like that, and having them go see them go for world records or go for placing, that was pretty exciting.
So how did you get that job as the assistant coach?
So Matt Gary helped me a lot along the way. So I asked him how I can get more and more involved. And the first thing I did was in 2013, I took the USAPL coaching course when they pretty much started bringing it back. It was in 2013 Raw Nationals. So I took the course there and I asked him, hey, how did you get to where you did, you got? So he explained to me how he basically got on as a personal coach with Susie making teams, and he eventually became an assistant coach and eventually became a head coach. So I actually came on as a personal coach in 2014 in South Africa when Jordan Burke, who is Squash Science president, made the team for the 74 Open. And then our other buddy, Nate Zephyr, who makes our inhale smelling salts, actually also part of Squad of Science, made the team for the 120 juniors. So I went on as a personal coach for them, got to meet the other coaches, got to meet the other lifters, helped out in the warm room with our lifters, and just built slowly from there. Where the following year they said, hey, do you want to come be an assistant coach? And then after the coach stepped down, I applied to be a head coach. So I sent them my resume for the sub junior and junior team to be the head coach, and I got that team.
That's awesome. So this is one thing I've always wondered myself. How is it handling people at world level meets that have different coaches?
You mean how does USAPL do it, or how is it for me, my experience?
How is it for you and your experience handling somebody like a Kimberly Walford or a Blaine Sumner that has somebody else doing their coaching, but you handle them on meet day at those world level meets?
So most of that, where especially for them, they're very experienced. They have their own coach. They also themselves kind of coach other lifters, so they know what to expect as far as warm-ups, attempts, the rules, that kind of stuff. It's mostly just putting them in the best mental state, warming up and doing the attempts, and then just making small adjustments based on maybe how the second attempt looked, picking the third attempt, whether it's a range of 2.5 kilos or 5 kilos. And always that final second and third deadlift, figuring out the placing. So I'm not doing too much as far as like trying to fix their technique or try and change their whole plan, since they already came in knowing, or the whole training block is based on what numbers they're going to hit. And just their coach knows what they can, are capable of. It's just making those small adjustments.
So the other coach will come to you with and the lifter will come to you with kind of like suggested attempt selections, and then based upon the way the competition's going and stuff, you just kind of make the adjustments per what you see.
Yep. So in the USAPL national team contract, it says you have to stay in communication with the head coach, with your training, with your body weight. And depending on how each coach runs the team, they might ask the lifter to send in. For example, I asked my team this week, send in what you have in mind for your warmups and your attempts. And I'll look at that compared to the videos they've sent me, compared to the training information they sent me, and say, hey, maybe you should make these adjustments, or maybe this warmup would be better. Or if it all looks good, then we just stick with the plan that the lifter or the coach came up with.
Okay. So you're in constant communication with them throughout the training process. So it's not like a couple weeks before you guys are just getting together type of thing.
Yeah. It all depends on the team. Our raw team is newer than the equipped team, so we're building ours and improving ours all the time. But for this team, for myself, for the sub juniors and juniors this year, I asked for 5 training updates. So at 6 weeks out, up to 1 week out. And then also this week, sending the sheet I use for attempts and saying, fill it out with what you have in mind for warmups and attempts, what you have in mind for your goals for the competition. What's your number one priority? Is it your PR total? Is it your placing? Is it world records? That way I can see what's going on in the mind of the lifter and the coach, and then possibly just give suggestions of changes.
Okay. So we have IPF Worlds coming up. So this is kind of a good segue into it. And you got the sub junior and junior teams, correct?
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about IPF Worlds, kind of go into some expectations, where it is, maybe just give even the details of where people can watch the live stream, the dates, the times, all that stuff.
Yep. So the championship actually starts tomorrow with the Masters and goes all the way through to the 17th, when it goes from Masters, sub juniors, juniors, and Open. And this year it's going to be in Calgary, Canada. So not too far of a trip for us, which obviously helps us as far as the cost, and also traveling and the change of time zones is not as bad as, for example, going to South Africa or Finland. So it should be good performances for USA, Canada, and other countries in this area. So for my sub junior and junior team, It will be on the 10th, 11th, and 12th. So I head out on the 8th to be there in time, meet up with everyone, and get ready for those 3 days. Then I'm helping out with just a couple lifters in the open. For the live stream, they'll be posting it on the IPF YouTube, and they'll be posting on the Facebook IPF. But the main website to go to for everything is called goodlift.info. So on that website, goodlift.info, they have nominations for all the international championships. So you can go there and see what lifters each country is sending, what their nominated totals are. That will also have the link to the live stream and the scoring sheet each day for each day's lifting.
Awesome. How many sub-juniors and juniors will you be coaching up there?
So we have a full team, so it's 34, because it's going to be 9 sub-junior men, 8 sub-junior women, and then also 9 junior men and 8 junior women.
Okay, that's a lot to handle on in a few days. I'm sure you're gonna earn your paycheck for that one.
So
how do you guys manage that many lifters at a big meet like that?
So part of it depends on the location. For example, in 2016, when it was in Texas, and now when it's in Canada, a lot of the personal coaches want to come because it's close and it's cheap to fly to. So I tell them early on in February, I send an email, if your personal coach wants to come out, fill out the form. That way I already know which lifters have their personal coaches there that are going to be helping them with the warm-ups and attempts and rack heights and weigh-ins and everything like that. And then based on that, whoever doesn't have their personal coach coming, then I can start filling those spots in with my assistant coaches for my team and obviously myself. When it's
How many assistant coaches do you have?
This year, because it's in Canada, we don't need that many. I have 3. So Bill McCarthy, Brad Couillard, and Tina Donishman.
Okay. And if it's in a location where a lot of the personal coaches aren't traveling to, how many assistants do you tend to bring?
So that's the downside, though, is also some of the assistant coaches don't want to come. So last year we went to Belarus, and so a lot of the personal coaches didn't come. But it was also difficult to get assistant coaches for the team that want to pay their own way to come over there and handle lifters. So I had to pull some coaches that were up from the Masters team or from the Open team. And then I also had to pull some personal coaches who have been around a long time, experience, say like, hey, can you stay for another session and help out with this lifter? Or, hey, can you come back tomorrow? You're not busy and help out with this session. So it might be 4 or 5 team coaches plus myself when you use everyone up from all the different days and sessions.
I mean, it's pretty cool that there's a community of people who are willing to help each other like that under those circumstances.
Yeah. It certainly helps that it's either 1 or 2 platforms usually versus like the 1 year in Raw Nationals where we had 5 platforms. And then it helps that with Raw lifting, it's a little easier. You can have 1 coach just warming everyone up in the warm-up room and then send them to the platform. And me or another coach can just pick their attempts. Whereas with other teams that are like equipped teams, it's very important of who's wrapping their knees or who's setting the shirt right. So it makes it a little more difficult for them when they have to try and handle a lot of lifters.
Has there been a world championship where there were 5 platforms like there were in like Atlanta Raw Nationals?
As far as I know, IPF used to be a lot of 1 platform because it wasn't as many lifters. And now that they've implemented the Raw World Championships, the various ones along with the equipped, now you're getting a lot more lifters competing. And especially with the Raw World being all the age divisions together, it becomes a lot of lifters at one time. So they've done 2 platforms, but I've never seen more than 2 platforms.
Okay. And 2 platforms is pretty manageable, but it can still be, I would imagine, can still be pretty hectic under certain circumstances.
Yeah, it just depends on, for that session, how many weight classes they put together and how many lifters we have, because we can have up to 2 lifters in a weight class. So we might have 2 lifters in 1 weight class, 2 lifters in another weight class, and we'll have 4 lifters in that session on 2 different platforms going at the same time. So it can get a little hectic, but it's still manageable.
So if you have, say, 4 lifters, 2 of them on each platform, do you just divvy up to another coach to do the attempts and stuff on 1 platform, and you would just take 1 platform, or how do you guys kind of manage those situations?
Yeah, that's always the plan going in, is I try and have 1 coach in charge of that entire platform. So for example, some of the sessions next week, will be two platforms. So I'll be in charge of one platform and say Bill McCarthy will be in charge of the other platform as far as putting in attempts, going to the jury, anything like that. But obviously, if it happens, the timing to be well between the attempts where I can watch Lifter on one platform, put in an attempt, and then go watch Lifter on the second platform, then obviously it's beneficial for us to have another set of eyes there watching and seeing any issues or figuring out what attempt to pick. We make adjustments on the day.
And you try to just watch as much as you can without obviously like interfering with the flow of the meet, like for the other lifters.
Yeah, and they try and be strict about only letting one coach coming out to the coaching box to watch the lifter, but they usually have a video in the back so we can watch the TV screen and watch the live stream in the back, or maybe have a coach go around to the front and watch from the front just so we can see the different angles to see if the judge is calling for something for these. Sometimes it can be a little harder to see from the side if the plates are blocking the view or something like that. So we try and do whatever we can to make the best for our team.
I always would like in a warm-up area, like during these, if there's multiple platforms, to have all the TVs of each platform in one spot somewhere so you can kind of still monitor what's going on the other ones at the same time as paying attention to one of the other platforms. Like I remember like last year in Nationals, they had the TVs, but it's like of the platform in front of you and you don't really know what's going on the other ones if you have lifters or whatever, and it can get pretty hectic.
Yeah, it all just depends on what setup, what kind of square footage the meet director has and what kind of equipment they have, how many TVs they have. But yeah, then you have to run from platform one to look at the scoring and the live stream on platform one over to platform five to look over there. And everyone's huddled around the scoring sheet. You can't see the monitor. So there's always issues, but we deal with it.
it keeps it interesting anyways. Yeah. I have one final question about competing at like world level meets and stuff. And it's about travel. So obviously you had alluded to where closer meets, the countries closer to the actual location of the competition tend to do better. So for the longer meets, how does that travel affect performance and maybe give some tips on how to handle longer travel? Like for us, for Raw Nationals, we're traveling across the country. So maybe some tips for changing time zones, all that stuff.
Yeah, so there's a few things with flying that causes issues. One of it is, I don't know the exact percentage, but the air that they use in the plane while you're flying is very low humidity. And so the very low humidity dries out your lungs and can dehydrate the person if they're not drinking water on the flights. The other thing people might not think of is, let's say in a regular day, you're drinking 1 gallon of water, but if you're going on few different flights, 4-6 hours, you might be drinking just a little cup of water they give you. And so you're not getting your regular intake of water. So those things combine and people get dehydrated once they land in wherever city they are. They go drink and eat normal. Their body just holds on to all that and then they can't drop the weight. So that's one of the major issues people have. So we always try and recommend to people drink water on the flights, buy a bottle of water at the airport, bring shaker bottle, whatever, fill it up with at the water fountain at the airport and make sure you're getting the same amount of water as you would in a regular day. Or if you're loading more, especially on the flights.
So if they are in a water load, would you recommend them increase their intake more than what like their water load calls for? Or would you just tell them, make sure that they're getting what they're supposed to get?
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily increase it, but make sure that they're getting it. And it's also dispersed throughout the entire day. So I have a lifter that I coach who's competing at Worlds and he's coming from Indonesia. So he has to take a lot of flights. He says it's going to be like 24 hours overall of flights. And so what I don't want is for him to drink, let's say the 2 gallons in 2 hours after he gets all the flights. I want it separated throughout the whole day between the flights, whatever he's flying to, whichever city. So it's spread out and it's not all shoved into a certain time after they get off the plane.
So he's changing time zones and stuff. So somebody like that, how many days ahead would you recommend that he gets to the location to try to get acclimated to the timing?
For our personal teams, USAPL usually recommends at least 2 days in advance to get to the location. Some lifters, especially for the farther travel, come in earlier. So he's actually started flying yesterday to get there basically today, and he doesn't compete until the 10th. So he gets another 5 days in Canada to get acclimated to the time zone change, the food there, make sure he's all settled in, everything like that, any grocery shopping he needs to do, and also do his weight cut there. So he gets 5 days. I know some lifters that used to come from Australia, and they would come 5 to 7 days early because it's just a long flight, and be able to get one or two of their last light sessions in the location just to loosen up after the flights.
I would imagine too, if the you know, the elevation or something is a little bit different, like lifting under those conditions probably helps a little bit.
Yeah, I would imagine, definitely.
I would imagine too, doing your weight cut in the middle of flying 24 hours would be freaking misery. So it makes sense to actually get there and do that ahead of time.
So for my lifter who left yesterday, I just told him, make sure you're drinking water on the flights. And then once he lands in Canada, he has 5 days to do his load and his cut.
And when he gets to Canada, so he's used to certain foods in Indonesia and stuff. Is he going to try to find foods that are similar to what he's used to? Or how does he go about like with his actual like eating once he's there to make sure nothing negatively affects him?
Yeah, we try and recommend to all our lifters, and I'm sure other countries do the same, to bring food that you normally eat from wherever you live with you. Depending on what location it is, you might want to bring more or less. For example, I think like 10 years ago or so, they had a championship in India. And so a bunch of lifters brought canned meats and whatever snacks they could bring with them, because the food there causes a lot of food poisoning and people get sick. And I know there was one lifter, I believe he was on the junior team, who got food poisoning, lost a bunch of weight. All his gear was loose on competition day and he bombed out of the competition. So the more that they can pack in their bags and bring with them and try and eat that stuff before the competition, then the better off they'll be. And then they can eat the regular food after the competition. With somewhere like Canada, it's probably not as bad. And so it won't make as big of a deal if they eat the beef or the chicken or some of the vegetables and stuff in Canada. And in some cases, actually, the food might be better than what we have in the States.
That's probably true. All right. Arian, let everybody know where they can find you on the internet, maybe where they can purchase the Open Barbell system if they're interested in that stuff. Let's do that.
Okay, well, we'll throw that in there. So our website is squatsandscience.com. So on there, you'll see all our products on there. There'll be a section on coaching, and then we'll have a section on Open Barbell, which is now transitioning into Rep 1. And then we'll have information there for our wrist wraps and our ammonia salt inhale that you can buy. So all that information on there. And on Instagram, we also have the Squat to Science account on there that you can follow. And we make posts about all our products. And then myself, obviously, is Arian Tank. People think I'm calling myself a tank. And there's actually one lifter on our open team, Nick Tailuki, in 2015, that would just started calling me Tank because of that. But actually, it's actually my dog's name is Tank. So when I made my Instagram account, I was like, okay, my name is Arian. My dog's name is Tank. I like to post with my dog. So that's the Instagram account I made.
I actually had it on my list to ask you where that Instagram came from.
So yeah, Nick Tailuki, whose nickname is The Freak. He just started calling me the Tank in 2015 at Worlds.
I mean, it's a pretty sick nickname.
Yeah.
Arian, thank you very much. I know you're busy. Good luck at Worlds to you, all 34 of your lifters. Hopefully America does extremely well, which I'm sure they will.
Yeah, we usually do well, especially on this team for Raw. So I expect to be a lot of first place teams again, a lot of world records. It's going to be a pretty exciting championship. So thank you.
Hell yeah. And guys, make sure you follow me on Instagram. I'm KWCan, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.